Today on The World, a ship captain is cleared of wrongdoing in Italian court. She had risked her freedom to rescue migrants adrift in the Mediterranean and bring them ashore.
It's a clear sign to all other captains on the Mediterranean Sea that it makes sense actually to follow the law of the sea and to respect human rights for people in maritime distress.
Also today, a Black Lives Matter moment in Israel as Israeli Ethiopians demand an end to police brutality against their community.
Things have to be fixed immediately, and that's why we are going out to the streets and protest.
Plus, why Lee Iacocca committed himself to honoring our country's immigrant roots.
America had been great to him, and he felt it. He really felt it.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. A war crime. That's how the United Nations envoy to Libya describes what happened there today. An airstrike killed more than 40 migrants in a detention center near the country's capital, Tripoli. The attack is blamed on forces loyal to the warlord Khalifa Haftar, who's been trying to seize control of Tripoli since April. The airstrike puts a spotlight on the detention centers in Libya and the migrants who find themselves trapped in Libya's dangerous civil war. Sam Turner heads aid efforts in Libya for Doctors Without Borders.
One thing that we have to be very clear on is that these are not camps. These are not humanitarian shelters. These are not locations of safety. There is no safe place for the people who are trapped, who are locked up. They are detained in these centers, much like a prison.
Have you actually visited the Tajura migrant center that got hit by this airstrike?
Yes, I've been a number of times. Most recently was just following the last airstrike on Tajura Detention Center, which was in May. And fortunately, in that one, there were far fewer casualties, but a piece of shrapnel was thrown through the roof of the women's cell and landed on the ground just a meter away from where a baby was sleeping on a mattress on the ground.
Well, after this attack, the survivors in the camp are in shock. They're traumatized. What can you tell us about the people who are being held there?
They're from all over the world, most predominantly East Africa, but also West Africa. Also, there's a number coming from the Middle East, so fleeing war zones in places like Syria or coming from as far afield as Bangladesh.
We've also heard about a lot of migrants who get rescued in the Mediterranean trying to get to Europe and then are sent back to Libya where they came from. How many migrants in that kind of situation are at Tajura?
Absolutely. I mean, this is something that has been a key component of the EU and EU member state very cynical policies to support the Libyan Coast Guard to intercept those boats that are trying to make the crossing and return them to detention centers in Libya. Over the course of the conflict, which has now been raging for 3 months of fighting in the city of Tripoli, we have seen thousands of people who have been intercepted at sea and returned to detention centres, even whilst there is conflict raging around the city, and even though that detention centre has already been hit once and now in the last 24 hours has been hit again with horrific results.
Some people have blamed the carnage at Tajura on the EU for failing to have a uniform policy in place for resettling refugees and migrants. Is that fair, do you think?
It is not just a failure of not having a uniform policy to resettle refugees and migrants from Libya, but it is the policy to ensure that they are returned to those very same detention centres and, at the very least, complicity in their silence of politicians who are happy to see the current situation continue because they believe that it acts to dissuade other refugees and migrants from attempting to make the crossing.
As far as the abysmal conditions in these detention centers in Libya, I feel I have to ask you this. We've been getting reports, as you know, of migrants languishing in U.S. government facilities along the U.S.-Mexico border. We've learned that these conditions did not start under Trump, but that Trump is letting the situation get worse. Obviously, what happened in Tripoli is beyond the pale when we're talking conditions for migrants. But how much do countries look at the example the U.S. has been setting and believe that they can do the same with impunity?
I think the role of these international leaders is incredibly important in influencing what people think they can get away with across the world. And that's not only in the very concrete example of detention centers themselves, but also the way that we talk about people who are on the move, to consistently vilify them and use language that dehumanizes them is clearly setting a trend across the world in terms of how people feel that they are able to manage these people and manipulate for their political gain.
Sam Turner heads the mission for Libya for the aid group Doctors Without Borders. He's been speaking with us from our studios at the BBC in London. Thank you, Sam, for your time.
Thank you very much.
Migrants who are trying to leave Libya and other unstable places around the Mediterranean sometimes embark on a perilous sea crossing. And people like Captain Carola Rakete patrol those waters to rescue migrants who've capsized while trying to flee. Today, a judge in Italy has freed the German ship captain. She was detained over the weekend for challenging Italy's closed ports policy. Rakete had forced her ship, the Sea-Watch 3, into port of the Italian island of Lampedusa. She said many of the 40 rescued migrants on her ship were in need of emergency medical care. Ruben Neugebauer is a spokesman for Sea-Watch. I asked him about the judge's ruling.
Basically, the Italian judge showed that the Italian constitution is more important to him than a tweeting minister. Basically, he recognized that all Carola Rakete did was totally in line with international law. She rescued people in maritime distress and brought them to the closest port of safety. The judge said it was the right of Carola to actually moor in that port and even to resist the police in that case. Tunisia and Libya are no port of safety as it is recognized under international law, and that's why Carola Rakete just had no other chance than to bring the people to Lampedusa and to safety.
Now, the tweeting minister you're referring to, presumably Matteo Salvini, the interior minister, he's not happy with this ruling, is he?
He's absolutely not happy because his policy is actually against the Italian constitution. He is making a policy that the United Nations have said are violating human rights and international law. So he failed with this policy. And yeah, that's a big loss for Salvini and it's a big victory for human rights.
Italy's government did shutter its ports, though, to migrant rescue vessels in June of last year. So as a sovereign government, it has a right to do that. Captain Rakete ignored that law, didn't she?
Yeah, but actually, if there is a boat in a state of necessity, it's actually not the right of a sovereign state to shut their doors because human rights are universal and they do not recognize passports. You would not stop an ambulance at a certain border, would you?
So what were those 2 weeks like for Captain Carola Rakete and those migrants on the boat when they were stranded in international waters during the standoff?
It's a situation in which you have people on board that just escaped torture camps in Libya, and now they're again in custody. In the end, Carola Rakete had no other chance than to enter the port because the situation was deteriorating. People were threatening to throw themselves overboard. We had medical emergencies that had to be evacuated, but Caro could not just wait for every single person to become a medical emergency before she enters port.
Ruben, have you had a chance to speak with Captain Rakete or any of the migrants who are on the boat?
I have had a chance to speak to Carola. She's fine. She's pretty happy about the judgment because it's a clear sign for solidarity and it's a clear sign also to all other captains on the Mediterranean Sea that it makes sense actually to follow the international law and the law of the sea and to respect human rights for people in maritime distress.
It does sound like this could come up again, perhaps not with Captain Rakete, but likely with another ship rescuing migrants at sea. Do you intend to keep fighting the Italian government on this?
Of course, we will continue to enforce human rights on the Mediterranean Sea. We will continue to follow the international law as we always did, because it's not a crime. It's not fighting a government to rescue people in distress. It's a government fighting basic human principles if you criminalize sea rescue.
So what will happen to the migrants who were on the Sea-Watch 3?
They are now in Lampedusa. They might be distributed to other European countries now. That's not pretty clear, but the most important thing is that they are on land, that they are in safety, and that they do not have to risk their life again.
Ruben Neugebauer with Sea-Watch, thank you very much for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
The deadly fire on board a small nuclear submarine is front and center for Russian President Vladimir Putin. Pope Francis expressed his condolences for the 14 sailors who died in the incident. Tomorrow, Putin has a long-scheduled audience with Pope Francis at the Vatican. In the background of that meeting is a deep divide between the Russian Orthodox Church and the Ukrainian Orthodox Church and Rome's own role in the politics of these two religions. Irina Duquesnoy is a research fellow of Georgetown University's Berkeley Center for Religion, Peace, and World Affairs. Putin and the Pope have met two times before. Why are they meeting again? What do they actually have to talk about?
My impression is that Putin is meeting with Pope Francis as part of a larger visit to Italy. But also, it so happens that there are issues for them to talk about, specifically the situation in Ukraine and also, as I understand it, the situation in the Middle East. Because in terms of the latter, both the Pope and Putin have positioned themselves as people who are particularly worried about the fate of Middle Eastern Christians.
What do you think is Putin's motive behind kind of representing Middle East Christians? I mean, Russia's intervening in the war in Syria. Do you think he's trying to kind of burnish what they're trying to do there?
Oh, sure, of course. Russia has had a historically strong relationship with the Christian population of Syria and Palestine in general. You know, the reality is that the Middle Eastern Christians are in trouble. And for whatever reason, you know, the Putin government is, from a strategic point of view, it's a use of soft power to say, like, look, we're here, you know, just trying to be friendly and nice and, you know, forget about the bombs that are dropping around, you know, from our plans.
They met in 2015 a second time. And at the time, Pope Francis urged everybody, all the parties in the Ukrainian conflict, to kind of make a sincere effort for peace. What will the Pope tell Putin about eastern Ukraine and Crimea that he'll listen to this time?
Well, honestly, I think he'll say something about peace, and I think nothing's going to happen. You know, I don't think Putin is going to listen to anything. You're aware that in Ukraine there is a situation around the Ukrainian Orthodox Church, right? Which, as of this year, there is a split in the Ukrainian Church over part of it sort of officially acknowledges the Patriarch of Moscow as their head, and part of it has now formed this new organization which says that, you know, that we're our own sort of independent Orthodox Church. And this was kind of a really big deal, the split. And one of the things that has happened is that in addition to this Orthodox situation, in Ukraine there is a Greek Catholic Orthodox Church, which...
In addition to the Ukrainian Orthodox Church.
Yes, and this Greek Catholic Church, what it is a church that practices Orthodox rites. In other words, their liturgy and all of their services, all of their cultural accoutrements, right, are Orthodox. But they acknowledge the Pope of Rome as their head. So they belong to the Roman Catholic Church officially. And one of the things that's happened is that this new Ukrainian church, they've made noises about unifying with the Ukrainian Greek Catholics.
Which would push them more towards the Catholic Church, it would seem.
Well, it's not clear what it would mean, really. Hmm. It could mean that. It could... Nobody really understands what it means. And the thing is that the day after Putin is meeting with the Pope, there's going to be a very large delegation of Ukrainian Greek Catholics coming to the Vatican to speak with Pope Francis about this and other issues. So I think I have a sneaking suspicion that it's not a coincidence that Putin is meeting with the Pope the day before.
What is possible? Like, when you look at the issues, Irina, between the Kremlin and the Vatican, what is your best hope for what this meeting could produce?
I think it's going to produce a statement of some kind about the Middle Eastern Christians. It may actually produce some concrete action plans for how to help the Christians of the Middle East. I think what the Russian side might be hoping, given that the Pope is meeting the very next day with the Greek Catholics from Ukraine, that maybe he'll tell them that, hey, don't unite with this new Orthodox Church that's anti-Russian. Basically, don't do anything on the ground that could stoke tensions and make people even more upset than they already are. I don't know if Pope Francis is going to go along with that, but I would imagine that that's a request.
Irina Dikenois with Georgetown University's Berkeley Center for Religion, Peace, and World Affairs. Thank you very much for explaining this.
Sure. You're welcome.
The fastest growing social media app in the world and concerns that it's being used to scam its youngest users. That story just ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. It's bigger than Snapchat, Twitter, and LinkedIn, but it's mostly teenagers who are using it. TikTok, the fastest-growing social media app in the world, but has come under scrutiny for the practice of gift baiting. That's when TikTokers use their live broadcasts to coerce young fans into sending them hundreds of dollars in digital gifts. The BBC's Joe Tidy reports.
Rainbow, one more and I film you direct live. And Anthony, thank you for two concerts.
Stumbling into a TikTok live stream can be bewildering. But once you learn the shorthand and jargon, it's clear. TikTok celebrities are effectively selling their attention.
Remember, if you are the next person to click that gift box and send a concert, you get a follow. If you send
concerts, rainbow pukes and pandas are all the names of gifts These animated cartoons pop up on screen during live streams, highlighting the gifter's username. The little ones cost pennies, but the biggest one, called a drama queen, costs users £49.
Oh, the drama queen!
Thank you for the drama queen!
And despite having well over 500 million users, the platform doesn't have any guidelines about what can and cannot be offered in exchange for gifts.
Yo, if you drop another drama queen, yeah, I'll speak to you on Instagram for a week straight. Yeah,
shout-outs, video collaborations and follow-backs are all common, but some fans feel exploited. We spoke to a 12-year-old girl from the northwest of England who didn't want our interview to be broadcast.
You gave a TikTok £100 during one live.
The perk being offered by her favourite TikToker was his phone number. But she says he's only replied to a few messages and has never answered her calls.
Boom, 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 boom. Oh, I'm giving her my number right now. And
Sebastian Moy didn't respond to our requests for comment.
Yeah, thanks so much for the drama queen. And, we're gonna
and she's not the only one who's given big gifts to TikTokers.
I think in the end it was about 400 by the time it was all said and done.
Stephanie Barber blames TikTokers for persuading her 11-year-old daughter to rack up the bill over two live streams.
Adults should know better, and even other teenagers and that should know better that you don't ask essentially children for money.
TikTok has a minimum age of 13, but it's widely accepted that many of its 500 million users are underage.
No, one more tap, one more tap.
The Nefati brothers are TikTokers on the up, with 2.5 million fans. From their Blackburn home, the 25-year-old twins record their dancing and comedy videos. When they go live, they ask for drama queen gifts worth £49 in exchange for followbacks. They also promise to write fans' names on their heads in pen if they send multiple drama queens. An average live stream earns them around £250.
Most of our gifters are like 30 to 45.
So how do you feel that sometimes the people that are giving you gifts are very young?
Well, we don't like it when our gifters are young. So basically, we ask them if their parents know about it. But we can't stop them. We are going on live not only for the money. We are going on the live to get more audience.
As well as fans buying gifts for creators, there's another group making money from TikTok users. I was approached repeatedly by an anonymous account. He asked me to send him gifts in exchange for likes on my videos. Clearly, preying on the common desire many fans on the app have to become famous themselves.
Like drop one drama queen, okay? One drama queen for 500 likes.
Send a drama queen, the £49 gift, and he'll get his team to artificially boost my popularity on the site. TikTok says it's sorry to hear about some of the experiences we documented.
If you send one more, you get my number, okay?
In light of our investigation, a spokesperson said they will further strengthen the platform's policies and features.
The BBC's Joe Tidy reporting on the social media platform TikTok and concerns that it's being used to gift bait young users. This summer, Montreal, up in Canada, is giving self-driving shuttle buses a try, a pilot project to help commuters on that first or last mile of their mass transit journey. The company that built these buses is called Easy Mile. Easy Mile also tested the boxy people movers in cities around the U.S. and the rest of the globe. We reached out to Sharad Agarwal, Senior Vice President of Easy Mile North America, to learn more about the bright red driverless buses in Montreal.
We can fit up to 15 passengers inside. There's six seats, and then the rest would be standing.
And what are the kind of routes that these buses are taking? Like, where typically are the buses taking people to and from?
So the main purpose of the shuttles today is for fixed route areas. So, for example, in Montreal, there's a specific route running around Olympic Park and some of the different connecting streets. We use shuttles on corporate campuses, hospitals, industrial parks, primarily a lot of dense areas where transportation is required.
It sounds like a lot of kind of short runs?
Correct. Generally, the routes are about a mile and a half and under.
So the buses are not going like 60 miles an hour. How fast do they go?
We average speed around 12 miles an hour.
So what does that mean in terms of power? Is it electric?
All the vehicles are electric.
Wow, that's pretty cool. So you're also seeing this as a green initiative?
Definitely a green initiative, yes.
The self-driving bus in Montreal is running on public roads, and I gather that's kind of a big deal. Why is that?
There's definitely some differences when you're running on a public road. You have mixed traffic. You have individuals that generally don't travel that road, so we need to plan for their reactions. In Montreal, we're actually integrating with the stoplights to go across. You have parked cars. So there's definitely different challenges in the environment.
I know there have been some pretty big problems with a few driverless cars being developed, and that's resulted in some tragedies. How do you know the Easy Mile self-driving buses won't make a mistake? I mean, is that still a concern?
Well, we try to prepare by making sure the environments that we're operating are pre-mapped. We typically give suggestions to the cities and our partners on different mitigation strategies, things like signage to make people aware that the vehicle is happening. Also, our technology is built in a significant amount of redundancy. So every obstacle detection feature that we have has another backup system working with it. And also today, in comparison to some of the ones you mentioned, our speeds are much slower. So we aren't seeing the same type of environment that you might see in the news.
What would happen if, like, some kid leaped out in front of the bus? I mean, do the sensors know that there's somebody there and can stop quickly enough?
Yes. Our vehicles are, using the LiDAR sensors, are looking quite a far ways out, making decisions. And so if someone comes into the path 50 feet away, it'll make a decision to start to slow down. If someone jumps right in front of it, the vehicle will immediately stop.
In terms of, like, what your long-term plan is the idea to kind of get passengers through these small distances that a lot of people can't actually do in any other way except by walking? Or are you starting small in Montreal and then hoping to just grow the size and speed of all these driverless buses?
Well, I think ultimately our technology is really well focused on the shorter distance travel. So if you have corporate campus is a good example where there's thousands of people that need to get from their parking lot to campus or around campus, universities where the distances aren't that great. And then really the last piece is the last mile connection where we want to be able to integrate into major hubs, both bus and rail, where it's too far to walk to make it a good, efficient journey. Those are another really good use case of our technology.
So I know Montreal, it's a lovely city, but it's got these terrible long winters and the streets get kind of icy. What you learn through this experiment right now with these driverless buses in Montreal, will it apply to, you know, the depths of a Montreal winter?
No, absolutely. We did full winter testing in Minnesota 2 years ago, so we got a lot of feedback. We're adapting the technology to really understand the differences between snow as an obstacle and ice, snowbanks, things like that. So definitely the learnings for Montreal will support that.
Now, Minneapolis is a great lab for that.
Yeah.
Sharad Agarwal of Easy Mile North America, thanks very much.
Thanks, Marco. Appreciate it.
You're listening to The World.
Hi. I want to tell you about a new PRX podcast called Things That Go Boom. It's all about foreign policy, but not in the way you might think. At Things That Go Boom, they tell stories about our lives and the world around us in an effort to better understand the ins, outs, and what have yous of what keeps us safe. On the new season, they tell the story of the secret back-channel meetings, political ploys, and even broken bones that led to the Iran nuclear deal. And since President Trump yanked us out of that deal, they ask, are we headed for nuclear war? Things That Go Boom's second season, called Fallout, is available now. Listen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Marco Werman. How did an Arctic fox travel more than 2,000 miles from Norway to Canada in just 76 days? By doing what Arctic foxes do.
They have this trot, this kind of a short gallopy thing, mm-hmm. which they seem to do forever. Seems hardly an effort at all, it looks like.
That story still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a production of WGBH, the BBC, PRI, and PRX. His parents christened him Lido Anthony, but the world knew him as Lee Iacocca. He died today at age 94. Famous for his storied career in the auto industry, running Ford Motor Company and the Chrysler Corporation, Iacocca said yes in 1982 when President Ronald Reagan tapped him for a special project to raise funds to repair the crumbling Statue of Liberty and refurbish the buildings at Ellis Island. Stephen Briganti and Iacocca worked together for decades on that project. Briganti now heads the Statue of Liberty, Ellis Island Foundation. He says Iacocca's Italian immigrant origins were central to his identity.
That was a very important part of his life. I think it made him work harder. I think it made him appreciate the country more because they struggled for a while. As a young boy, he had rheumatic fever, and he was unable to serve in the armed forces. And he told me that when President Reagan asked him to take over this job, he said, well, I've never really done anything for my country, and this is an opportunity for me to do it.
So Iacocca's own family had passed through Ellis Island not once, but many times, right?
Well, his father had. His father had come through four or five times, starting at the age of 12. The last time he went back, he brought back his wife, who was Iacocca's mother. So they have a strong link to Ellis Island.
Ellis Island, I mean, this is where the big immigration happened at the beginning of the 20th century, and Iacocca's family followed suit. They came through in the 1920s. A lot of immigrants from Southern and Eastern Europe came in, but were not always welcomed with open arms. As a son of Italian immigrants, did Lee Iacocca think some doors were closed to him?
Yes, he did. He does talk about, or had talked about, slurs against Italians, and there were a lot at that point in history. And in 1924, the government said, well, enough of these Southern and Eastern European people. We're going to put the quotas back to 1880 when they weren't coming. So he lived through the process of some schoolyard battering, but I think it made him all the stronger and more determined to do well, to prove that his family was just as good as anybody else, particularly the Fords.
Particularly the Fords. I mean, Lee Iacocca worked first in his career for Henry Ford Jr., and Ford fired him in 1978. Yes. Do we have any idea of why?
He just didn't like him. Now, why he didn't like him? Well, there could be a lot of reasons. He wasn't WASP.
A WASP, a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant.
He was brash and driven.
Nevertheless, when he was young, Lee Iacocca sounds like he did experience prejudice. How did Lee Iacocca see the role of immigration in American society?
Oh, he saw it as being very important. He was very pro-immigration, legal immigration, of course. He was very insistent that Ellis Island be done. You know, President Reagan had said you can't use any government money, so we had to raise the money first. And he was very much involved and very supportive of the whole idea of making Ellis Island the center of the story of the populating of America.
Yeah, I remember when all this started, because kind of the business model that Iacocca came up with was build this wall, get donations from people to have their ancestors' names who passed through Ellis Island on that wall. My father did that, got a dedication to my grandfather who came through in the late 1800s. The project is still happening today, but I gather the names on this panel suggest different origins today.
Well, they do, because first of all, that wall was set up really to allow people who weren't rich to honor their families. You know, Ellis Island was the recipient of poor people. Yes, the generations later have probably made it and become comfortable Americans, but they were descendants from poor people. So the idea was that you could be able to place your name or your family's name on a national monument without giving $1 million. And we charged $100. And we had thousands and thousands of people sign up, and they are still doing it today. Immigration has changed today. Some of the names that you see are different. They're Asian, they're African, they're Hispanic. They're still part of the American dream and part of the whole concept of America as a nation of immigrants.
So, Stephen, when was the last time you were at Ellis Island, and what thoughts about Lee Iacocca crossed your mind at the time?
I was at Ellis Island last week.
Wow.
We just built a new museum at Liberty Island, and I went over to Ellis. When I go to Ellis Island, I actually think of my own family, and that was one of the things that connected me with Lee. He thought of his family. My family came in 1911. I imagined my grandfather and my grandmother and my mother standing there waiting to be processed. They were standing in line. About 5,000 people a day on an average day were processed. Did your family come through Ellis Island?
My grandfather did, yes.
So I don't know if you've been there, but
I
always feel something. I feel something in my stomach. And Lee used to say, you know, every time I come here, I think about the fact that my father came four times. I could have been living in Italy, he said.
Mm-hmm.
But here I am, the chairman of the Chrysler Corporation, the chairman of the Statue of Liberty Ellis Island Foundation. America had been great to him, and he felt it. He really felt it.
Stephen Briganti heads the Statue of Liberty Ellis Island Foundation, a group Lee Iacocca founded. The two worked together on the project. Stephen, thank you very much for helping us remember Lee Iacocca today. Really appreciate it.
It's an honor for me to help you remember Lee Iacocca. He was a great man.
The U.S. Army brought tanks and other armored vehicles into Washington, D.C. last night. Baseball fans coming out of Nationals Park looked startled to see them rolling past. The world's history guy, Chris Wolf, joins me for this one. You also know a fair bit about the military, Chris. What are we hearing?
That's not a Sherman tank for sure, Marco. Those left the military service in 1957, despite Mr. Trump's suggestion that they would be included in tomorrow's parade. What we heard there were flatbed trucks bringing Bradley infantry fighting vehicles into Washington last night, escorted by the police. You can hear the police horns.
The military vehicles, of course, are part of President Trump's Salute to America July 4th festivities tomorrow. So what exactly is happening tomorrow that is so much different than normal 4th of July celebrations in Washington?
Well, Democrats are outraged already and expressing concern at the cost, the tone, and the potential for politicization with tomorrow's events. But the details themselves are pretty much under wraps still. There definitely will be more military marching bands than usual. But as far as we know, there are no battalions of foot soldiers ready to march through. And the armored vehicles, as far as we know, are just going to be on static display, not part of the parade itself. There'll also, of course, be a flypast by aircraft from all the different services, which will force the closure for an hour and a half of Reagan National Airport. And then the president himself will be speaking, which is pretty unusual. There'll be a VIP pen at the Lincoln Memorial for Mr. Trump's friends to watch the fireworks. Plus, of course, what's being touted as the longest fireworks in any July 4th celebration.
So it's unusual for the president to speak on the 4th of July.
Yes, it is. So there's a lot of concern. The White House is saying he will avoid any political comments and just talk about or pay tribute, rather, to the military.
So this is a military parade President Trump has wanted pretty much since he visited France and watched their military parade. You were in the United Kingdom's Army Reserve, Chris, as a soldier. Do you like military parades?
Well, I'm tempted to reply with a string of barrack room profanity at that suggestion, Marco, but I can't speak for all. Some do feel honored, especially officers. But on the whole, no. You sign up to defend the country, not to provide a prop for politicians. And besides which, parades are often unbearably boring and uncomfortable, and you're just standing or marching around in the heat and the rain when you could be with your family on a holiday weekend.
The militarization of Independence Day under Trump has been controversial. It's not unprecedented, though, is it? Not even in the United States.
No. On the very day the Declaration of Independence was signed back in 1776, John Adams wrote about what he thought would become the great anniversary festival of the country. He said it ought to be solemnized with pomp and parade. So the early republic did see a lot of military parades on July 4th, overseen by the presidents themselves. But that ended with Zachary Taylor. He was a general himself, and he just didn't see the need.
In my lifetime, I can recall ticker tape parades for patriotic heroes, but I don't ever remember seeing a big military parade in the U.S. for any reason. Am I right?
Yes, I have to give credit here to the Smithsonian Magazine. They did a lot of digging last year on this. And as a rule, military parades are reserved for big military victories. The end of the Civil War, the World Wars, and most recently the 1991 Gulf War. You know, in D.C. or New York usually. There was also some military show at the inaugurations of presidents early in the Cold War. You think Eisenhower and Kennedy. But generally, no. And the reason being is that this is a democratic republic that has, you know, in theory, achieved legitimacy through the consent of the governed. There's no need for an ostentatious show of military strength to intimidate the regime's enemies, foreign and domestic. You know, that's a mainstay of authoritarian regimes, you know, from Mussolini in Italy to Putin's Russia today. In fact, I saw a nice tweet from the emigre writer Julia Yoffe saying, "I left Russia for this."
The World's History Guy, Chris Wolfe, thank you, as always.
You're welcome, Marco.
How far can a fox trot? In the case of one female Arctic fox, very far. Scientists at the Norwegian Polar Institute put trackers on a few dozen local foxes there this spring, and one of those foxes really astounded them. In just 76 days, she covered more than 2,000 miles on land and ice from the Norwegian island of Spitsbergen to Ellesmere Island in the Canadian Arctic. Harald Steen is with the Norwegian Polar Institute, which published the news of the fox's achievement. So the fox had a tracking device on her. What did your scientists at your institute think when they kept seeing that she was traveling so far and wide?
Well, you just say, whoa. First you say, oh, something wrong. It's got to be hitching a ride with something.
Like she might have gotten on a boat or something?
Yeah, something like that. But obviously this one wasn't, because it started to behave like a fox. Stopped a little bit, got something to eat, kept on living.
I mean, the speed was pretty extraordinary, about 28 miles a day on average. Some days I read she traveled 100 miles. Was she running a lot of the time? Is that how you can account for some of these distances?
Yeah. They have this trot this kind of a short gallopy thing, mm-hmm. which they seem to do forever. Seems hardly an effort at all, it looks like. You know, they weigh 2.5 to 5 kilos.
Yeah, so that's like 5 to 10 pounds.
So it's just amazing how energy efficient these guys are.
How dependent was this fox on sea ice to get from the Norwegian island of Spitsbergen to Ellesmere Island in northern Canada?
Well, just to explain a little bit. So we are way up north, but still there's the Gulf Stream that brings warm water up in that region that melts the ice. So this fox traveled first eastwards, quite a distance, and then it got on the drift ice.
I see.
And then it moved north and started to move west again. So she made a long arch just tracking the ice, basically. So yes, she's completely dependent upon the ice to actually do that journey.
So not walking across the ice, but actually getting on a small piece of floating ice and drifting?
No. She is walking on the ice.
Oh, okay.
Jumping from floe to floe probably in places, but generally she will be running on the ice.
I have to ask you this. If climate change denialists use this as evidence that, hey, look, there's clearly enough sea ice in the Arctic, a fox walked across it from Norway to Canada, how would you respond to that?
We are experiencing very little sea ice up there. If it had been normal or what it was, it would have walked just straight west, basically, and don't have to do that detour far east to actually get on the ice.
So tracking devices were placed on some 50 Arctic foxes in Norway, but this was the only one that ventured out of the country. What does that tell you?
Pretty much all animal groups. There are always stray individuals that go on trips. We see it in just about anything that we monitor. That some go on long journeys. They are what you will say the long-distance dispersers. They are those that are creating new populations, those that are moving genes between populations far apart. Those have always existed and probably will always exist. And exactly what triggers it, we don't really know.
Foxes are not dogs, but they are in the larger family of dog-like animals. Dogs have been known to travel long distances, often with a purpose. Is there anything you can extrapolate using the parallel with dogs?
Not really. I don't think she knew where she was going. I think she was just moving, putting one leg in front of the other as fast as she could.
What kind of sound does this Arctic fox make?
They have this kind of screaming like a cat can sometimes make noises like that.
Uh-huh.
But they can also bark just like a dog.
And when they bark, is it kind of like a arf arf or is it more of a howl?
Arf. Yeah, but they are small animals, so it's not like a big hound or something.
Right. So this one Arctic fox, a real surprise that she traveled so far. But what was the original intent of the study?
This fox was tagged in connection to a study that we wanted to do in connection with working on tidewater glaciers and the disappearing fjord sea ice that we experience now in the Arctic. So we wanted to see how dependent the coastal foxes are on the sea ice and how much they used it. So that was the purpose of the study. So this is a complete byproduct.
Must have been a fun byproduct to get out of the study.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Harald Steen with the Norwegian Polar Institute. Thanks for speaking with us about this very speedy fox. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you very much.
The map of where this little fox ran in her 2,000-mile sprint across the Arctic is pretty inspiring, even for us non-foxes. Take a look at theworld.org. Police brutality against young men of color. That story has taken over Israel in the past few days after an Israeli police officer killed a young Israeli Ethiopian man in the city of Haifa. Protesters have blocked highway traffic, and in a few cases, things got violent. In one incident, demonstrators turned over a car next to a pile of burning debris in the street. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu put out this statement. We all mourn the tragic death of Solomon Tekka, Netanyahu said, but stop blocking roads. Meharetta Baruch is a former deputy mayor of Tel Aviv. Thanks for being with us. Who was this young man, Solomon Tekka, and what happened to him?
Well, Solomon Tekka was standing with his friends outside of a youth club. We don't know exactly the details, but we know that the situation ended up with the killing of Solomon Tekka. And in the last few days, the Ethiopian community in Israel went out to protest Solomon Tekka's killing by police officer. But you know, it's very tragic because Solomon Tekka was not the first one. 5 months ago, we were protesting against the killing of Yuda Biadge by a police officer.
So when police kill a young black man in the U.S., there often follows a sharp debate about whether the police were being overly aggressive. Has that happened in Israel with these incidents?
Yeah, unfortunately. I mean, there is police brutality against young black men, incidents that Ethiopian young men were killed. So things have to be fixed immediately. And that's why we are going out to the streets and protest.
We should say, Meharita, that you are part of the Ethiopian community in Israel. What are you hearing from protesters who are aggrieved by the killing of Salomon Tekka?
You know, actually, this protest, they are organized by teenagers. There is no leader for those protests, but we can hear the anger and the disappointment of young men and women. The killing of Salomon Tekka was like a bullet for each and every one of us. That's the feeling. Me as a mother, I can say that I'm afraid to the future of my boys, my children. And, you know, it's very frustrating. And we demand the government of Israel and the police to do a real conclusion to overcome those incidents. We will not bear the killing of children and men in our community.
It does feel, though, like the anger has really spilled over. I mean, dozens of people have been injured in 2 days of protests, demonstrators and police officers. We saw one quote, "These flames cannot be extinguished," said one protester. Where is the anger and frustration coming from?
The anger and the frustration coming from, you know, the everyday life, the everyday racist approach that we receive, not only from the police but also from some systems in the Israeli society. It doesn't start with, you know, with the bullet that shot Salomon Tekka. It starts way before.
When you hear about young black men in the U.S. Being killed by police officers, does that resonate with you?
Yeah, actually, it's frightening because, you know, it takes you to the behavior of racism, which is very dangerous. I can see the similarity of those incidents, but I hope that in our country we will overcome those problems. And I know that my community, the Ethiopian community, really loves Israel, that dreamed about Israel and did a journey that cost us in lives in order to get to Israel. We are ready to serve our country. We love our country. And that's why I'm optimistic. But for now, it looks like, a love that was not accomplished.
Meharita Baruch, former deputy mayor of Tel Aviv, speaking about the death of Salomon Tekka, an Ethiopian-Israeli man shot by police a few days ago. Meharita, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're probably thinking about what to put on tomorrow's July 4th grill. Let's put the fire on pause for a moment and talk about fish, though, cooked without any heat. Ceviche. My BBC colleague Martin Ripple is from Peru, where ceviche is considered a national dish. So to share his memories of home, Martin decided to make ceviche for friends in his adopted city of London.
Actually, it is very, very easy to prepare. The recipe has only 5 ingredients: fish, red onion, lime, ají, which is a Peruvian chili, and salt. That's it. It's not complicated at all to prepare. You just need to dice the fish, then slice the onion. Put that in a bowl, then you should squeeze some limes on it, maybe 6 or 7, and add a little or a lot of ají, depending on if you like spicy food or not. Then you add some salt and gently mix it. It was a whole new drama to find the proper ingredients in London. Of course, it was not such a problem to find red onion, and well, even where we Peruvians are a little fussy about our limes, the ones that you buy in London are quite good. To find a proper fish is a little bit harder. So there was a period of trial and error in which I was looking for a white fish that could match the ones we use in Peru. I would say that the really hard thing was to find a proper chili. As in Mexico, in Peru, we praise our chili. We call it ají, and it's very hard to find it in London. So once I used the Scotch bonnet chili pepper. Oh my God. I was preparing the ceviche while crying. Just the smell was powerful. When I finished, my British friends just tried a little spoon of it, and that was it. They didn't want to eat anything more. I literally served them an atomic bomb on a dish. That was the first and last time I used that chili.
The BBC's Martin Riepel experimenting with Scotch bonnet peppers and ceviche in London, putting the exclamation point on our show today. Our theme music is by Ned Porter. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. If you're off tomorrow, happy 4th of July holiday to you. We'll be here, though. See you then.
PRI, Public Radio International.